This show is sponsored by Midi Health. There are great things that come with age: wisdom, experience, and knowledge, just to name a few. But if you're a woman over 40, it can also bring some less desirable things like hot flashes, insomnia, brain fog, moodiness, and weight gain, all symptoms of menopause and perimenopause. Yes, hormonal transition is a fact of life, but that doesn't mean you have to accept its symptoms as just another part of aging. Midi clinicians are menopause experts, equipped to support you with safe, effective, FDA-approved medications, as well as supplements, lifestyle coaching, and preventative health guidance. You'll come out of the experience feeling heard and with a plan to start feeling better. Midi offers accessible care. All their services are covered by insurance, and they're conveniently accessible through telehealth visits and 24/7 messaging. You deserve to feel great. Book your virtual visit today at joinmidi.com. That's joinmidi.com.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Saints Hour. Mike Haas, along with Saints Executive Vice President and General Manager Mickey Loomis. The Saints in Week 3 host Philadelphia, but fall 15-12, still 2-1 on the season, and a couple of big ones coming up. They all are at Atlanta on Sunday and then at Kansas City on Monday night. And Mickey, when this team was 1-0 and 2-0 and 2-1, it's perspective. It's a 17-game season filled with highs and lows, and it's just perspective and how you take the highs and how you handle the lows, correct?
Well, that's true. Obviously, you know, you have a better feeling after you get a win, even though you know that there's corrections to be made and, you know, things weren't perfect. And I think sometimes it's hard to recognize that same thing after a loss. But it was a heavyweight fight type of game against a really good team. And look, we had our chances and just couldn't close the deal.
And that's the tough part about it, because it's a loss. Doesn't matter if it was 52-50 or 15-12. And, you know, there's takeaways. There are a lot of positives. You held them to 15. You get two turnovers. I know Dennis speaks a lot about turnover on downs, and two of those and the blocked punt, I guess. The inability, I guess, to capitalize on some of those things. It was tough sledding, right?
Yeah. I mean, typically I think we got two turnovers. We got, I think, two fourth down stops. The block punt, you know, those things typically lead to about, 80 to 90% winner. And so when you don't get the win after those kinds of events, that makes it doubly hard to swallow.
And the same with the explosive plays, right? Something this team had not had issues with early on. Again, early on, it's been two games, but had issues with, but just the explosive plays that Philly was able to come up with.
Yeah, look, let's give them credit. They've got some really good players. They've got they're well coached. They have guys that can make explosive plays, and a couple of them did.
Yeah, and I, you know, we're not going to spend a wealth of time talking about that, but I do want to talk about their defensive tackles, right? Because if these guys were wide receivers, and you're the 13th overall pick in 22, Jordan Davis or the 9th overall pick in 23, I mean, that's hefty areas for defensive tackles. But those guys, and even Dennis said, I mean, you never want to lose the battle up front, but that was a very tough. Those two were very tough to overcome, especially when you lose Eric McCoy on the third play.
Yeah. Look, they're good players, and they had their A game going, and you mentioned it. We lost Eric, and so we had some shuffling on the front line, and I know Caesar was dealing with a few things as well. So they had a good game, but look, sometimes that happens and you have to overcome it. And look, there was a lot of good things that we did on offense. It wasn't like it was a game where there was nothing good that happened on offense. And I thought, our guys did a great job of having a late drive when we had to have it to take the lead. That was fantastic. Great play by Derek and the other guys on offense. And, and, uh, you know, I thought Chris Olave had a really good game as well. So there were a lot of really positives, but it just doesn't feel that way, you know, after you lose.
What can you tell us about Eric McCoy's situation moving forward?
Yeah, I think he's got an injury. It's going to require some time, and how much time remains to be seen. But it's going to be a little while.
And clearly, this team, because you didn't know going into the season, you know, even back in the spring, Ryan Ramczyk's situation, but it felt like, and it, you know, the offensive line in general, focus point, Lucas Patrick, Shane Lemieux, Ali Udo, Kyle Hergel. I mean, you can never have enough depth on the offensive line, but and this was an area that you, your team, and the personnel department really, really attacked hard in the offseason.
Yeah, look, I think our guys have done a great job of identifying offensive linemen that can help us. And look, in this day and age of football, you're going to need those guys. And James Hurst was a guy that we signed, you know, a few years back, you know, primarily to be our sixth lineman, and ended up starting a lot of games for us and playing really well. And you know, Lucas Patrick is kind of in that same mold. He's a veteran player that's had a lot of starts in his career, and you know, has come in and you know, did a really good job at left guard for us, and move over to center. You know, after Eric's injury, and they're just valuable guys to have.
And most recently, this has been kind of the norm, but the ability, because we probably don't give enough credit for what Lucas Patrick did, right? Left guard, all of a sudden you're taking snaps, which he probably took some, but not a lot in that week. But the ability of the today's offensive lineman, Udo, that can play guard and tackle, Shane Lemieux, that can play guard and center, the multi-positions is almost a mandatory now, isn't it, or very close to it?
Yeah, I think that's dictated a lot by – you know, the limitations we have on the roster, not just the 53-man roster, but also the game day active roster. You know, you can bring eight linemen to a game. And so, you know, the more versatile guys you can have in those backup roles, then the better off you are.
So as we get into the season and you're practice squad, you know, you have 17 guys on the practice squad, I think four offensive linemen, Deculus, Ezeerum, Hergel, and Lemieux. What's the pool like there? Because, I mean, Atlanta lost two offensive linemen on Sunday night. Don't know their status, and we'll know more this week, but Lane Thomas. So, I mean, what's the pool out there? Is it just about, hey, man, maybe we can get some depth if you have to go out there? I'm not saying you are. I'm just saying, what's the market look like after week three?
Yeah, I would say it's pretty thin because – you just mentioned it. There was a number of offensive line injuries, not just this last weekend, but in the prior two weekends. So that pool of players has been depleted. Now, the good news is that, look, you mentioned the guys that we have on our practice squad that we all have confidence in. In addition to that, you know, every team has offensive linemen on their practice squad, and they're available if you want to move somebody to your active roster. So there's a pool of players there. We'll look at that. We'll see where the best fit is for us, and then we'll move accordingly.
We'll be back with Saints Executive Vice President and General Manager Mickey Loomis after this. This is the Saints Hour on the New Orleans Saints Radio Network. We are talking with Saints Executive Vice President and General Manager Mickey Loomis, and this next question, oddly, does not even – really focus it at all on the Saints, but because you've had one offensive fourth down attempt. But this season, and maybe I started focusing on this with Sirianni on Monday night and then now, but I've noticed it so much. And so I was kind of looking in the number of teams, like Cleveland's gone for 11 fourth downs, Miami 10, two teams with nine, four teams with seven, four teams with six. I mean, the question is, what's different? Why is it? It feels like that number is enormously high for 3 weeks of football.
Well, look, I think that's a product of these analytics that you know, teams are buying into now. And look, the numbers say that over time, it's an advantage to go for it in a lot of situations. And so, you know, we have teams and coaches that buy into that, and probably rightfully so. I mean, it's risk versus reward. And, you know, I think the one thing that doesn't get considered enough is, look, it's all well and good to go forward on fourth down, but do you have a play that you really love that you feel really good about it being successful as opposed to just going for it to go for it? And so, but I think it's a product of risk reward and the math and, you know, the value of analytics.
Where are you on the use of analytics either during the week or for a game?
Yeah, look, we have some guys that do a great job in that area, and I look at it, and I think most teams look at it this way. It's a tool in the toolbox, and it's going to help you make decisions as opposed to making the decisions for you. And I think that's the way that most of the coaches in our league look at it is, look, they want the information. Ultimately, it's their decision. And sometimes you go with that. Sometimes you go with your gut.
Kind of along those lines, but just things that kind of jump out, just broadly speaking, you know, around the league. And it just felt like for years we have been, not you or, you know, kind of devaluing the running back and the running back who is 29 and whatever. And now, prior to the week three games, I think there were like 40% of the plays were running plays, where like in 2019, 5 years ago, that was 33%. So it just feels like the running game is being focused on and being utilized more. Now, you guys were already planning on doing it. You've run more run plays than pass plays every game. But it just, am I right in that assessment?
Well, I think, first of all, it's early in the season. I do think that, this idea, and it's true for the most part, is that it takes a while for offenses to get going in our league, you know, because of the way that we operate in the preseason, the limited number of practices, the timing required, particularly in the pass game, that just takes time to gel oftentimes, particularly if you have, you know, a new staff, new coaches, a different quarterback, you know, different skill position people, shuffling on the O-line. It just takes time to, to get in sync, so to speak. So it's easier to do that, I think, with the run game. And certainly, you know, one of the advantages of running the ball is that, look, you're controlling the clock, and the best defense is to keep the other team's offense off the field. So there's a lot goes into that. I do think that it's trending that we're getting back to the run game somewhat, but we'll see where that goes the balance of the season.
You play Atlanta, of course, on Sunday, and the bulk of your NFC South schedule is early this year. So you'll play five of your six. You play Atlanta on November 10th, and that's your last NFC South game on November 10th, week 10, until the last game of the season with Tampa. So it's very top-heavy from a schedule standpoint. They're all important. Don't get me wrong. I understand that. But it is with these next two at Atlanta, and then you get Tampa and Carolina and Atlanta again. It's very top-heavy this year as far as your divisional race.
Yeah, and that's unusual, because I think for us, most of those NFC South games have been in the latter part of the season. And I think in general around the league, that's been the case in the last few years. I don't know how that falls for other teams and other divisions in our league this year, but that is a little bit different. And you're right, you do feel like those games count a little more because there's tiebreakers involved. There's, you know, you're standing in the division. Obviously, our first and foremost goal is to win the division. So, we have a chance to make some hay over that stretch.
couple more questions. We'll take a break here. But just as you kind of look at some of the positives that you pull out of these first three games, again, it's three games, but had 10 penalties week one, five in week two, three in week three. And we've talked about the defenses being ahead of the offenses, and you've seen a lot of motion and pre-snap penalties, but that's an area that's considerably come down for this offense and this team, I should say.
Yeah, that was, look, that's one of the positives that happened in this last game. I think part of that is a function of the crew that you draw because, the officials, the different crew to crew, they call things some call them a little tighter than others. Some focus on certain areas that other ones, aren't as focused on. And so from week to week, that can change, but it's a good trend to have the penalties go that direction. There's no question about it.
I know it's the 24-hour rule is the same for wins and losses, but harder to flush this loss and get it out of the system, take that Dallas win and you immediately go to the next week, is it harder to kind of get this one out of your system?
I think losses are way harder to get over than the joy that you get from wins, and maybe that's just a function of how long I've been in the league and my age, but losses are definitely tough to get over, and you replay certain plays all over in your mind, certain things that happen, and look, these games often come down to one or two or three plays, and it certainly came down to that in this last weekend in a tough game against a really good team that we went, and I was proud of our guys because we went toe-to-toe with them. I felt like it was a really physical game, and I thought, there were a lot of good things that we did. And even though we only scored 12 points, I thought there were some good things that we did on offense as well. And obviously a lot of things we've got to clean up. When you score, 40 plus points in the first two games, you kind of come to expect that, right? And so then when you get a game like this, 15-12, look, there's games sometimes you have to win like this. It's just the nature of the NFL. We need to find a way to win these type of games. And I believe we have a team that can do that.
Take a break. When we come back, we will bring in Mike Golic. Mike Golic Sr., DraftKings Network, former defensive tackle for three NFL teams. Get his thoughts as we continue here on the Saints Hour on the New Orleans Saints Radio Network.
This show is sponsored by Midi Health. There are great things that come with age, wisdom, experience, and knowledge. Just to name a few, but if you're a woman over 40, it can also bring some less desirable things like hot flashes, insomnia, brain fog, moodiness, and weight gain, all symptoms of menopause and perimenopause. Yes, hormonal transition is a fact of life, but that doesn't mean you have to accept its symptoms as just another part of aging. Midi clinicians are menopause experts, equipped to support you with safe, effective, FDA-approved medications, as well as supplements, lifestyle coaching, and preventative health guidance. You'll come out of the experience feeling heard and with a plan to start feeling better. Midi offers accessible care. All their services are covered by insurance, and they're conveniently accessible through telehealth visits and 24/7 messaging. You deserve to feel great. Book your virtual visit today at joinmidi.com. That's joinmidi.com.
Welcome back to the Saints Hour. Mike Haas, along with Saints Executive Vice President and General Manager Mickey Loomis. We are joined now by Mike Golic Sr., 1985 draft pick with the Houston Oilers, played for 8 years, and of course, longtime ESPN. Now he's got a show with his son, Mike Golic Jr., Notre Dame. There's a lot to unwrap here. Mike, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks. I appreciate being here. It's always got to be interesting for the younger crowd listening when they hear I got drafted by the Houston Oilers. They're like, when the hell did you play? Houston Oilers.
Right.
Well, when did you, because I have kids, but when you were always Mike Golic, right? But when did you become Mike Golic Sr.?
Well, when I should have never named my son Junior. I never should have done that. Not following in playing football, not following working in the media business together. That's when it started. Is in the media business when we were both at ESPN. All of a sudden, they had to differentiate between the two of us. And so it was just easier going senior and junior than Mike Jr. and Mike Sr. But yeah, since obviously, you know, he was a junior, but playing as Mike Golic while I was out of football, I mean, it didn't have to worry about the junior then. But yeah, it was once he was in the media world, we had to go the senior junior route.
Mike, look, I know about your history at Notre Dame. I think you played with Steve Berline, right? And,
yep.
And Tim Brown. And
yep.
Man, those were heyday years for Notre Dame, the whole era. And, you know, Notre Dame was really college football for a lot. I grew up on the West Coast, and Notre Dame was a big deal there. Obviously, it was a big deal around the country. Tell me about your decision coming out of high school. Was it automatic you were going to go to Notre Dame? I know your brother played there. And but was it kind of fait accompli that you were going there, or did you have other options?
Yeah, I mean, I had other options, yeah. I this was back in the day when you didn't commit after your freshman year. You know, you took your five trips actually after your senior year was over. And I actually had five trips set up, I think, to Tennessee, UCLA. I almost said USC, but I wouldn't go to USC. Miami, Texas. I had a bunch of trips set up. I had taken a junior visit when I was a junior to Michigan. But I had always wanted to go to Notre Dame. And once the call actually came on Thanksgiving, that Jerry Faust offered me a scholarship, and I took it. And so, yeah, it would have taken a lot for me not to go there. Bob had kind of paved the way. It was just 4.5 hours from Cleveland. So, and my brother Greg was playing there. He was a freshman when I was a senior in high school. So, but it's funny you mentioned that the Berline and Tim Brown. Funny story about Tim. I was a senior captain when Tim Brown was a freshman, true freshman. And the opening game against Purdue, Tim Brown was returning kicks as a true freshman. And opening kick goes to him, and he fumbles it. Purdue gets the ball on like the 4-yard line. And, you know, we thought the offense was running on the field, quick change, the defense. Now we're throwing our helmets on and going out in the field. And I remember Tim was running off as true freshman, and I'm the captain, you know, the supposed leader. And I stopped in front of Tim and I said, Tim, don't worry about it. We're going to need you. Let it go. You know, all the things a captain should say to a player, especially a young player. I pat him on the butt and I keep running out in the field. And I say to myself, oh, that kid's never going to make it. Certainly called that one wrong.
That's awesome.
Yeah,
that is awesome. look, you get drafted by Houston, right? And yep. Who was the head coach at Houston your first year there?
My first year was Marion Campbell, and I broke my ankle in training camp. So I was on IR. It was back when you're on IR the whole year. So I was on IR the whole year. Then when I went my second year, with Jerry Glanville got his first head coaching job. And I was there with Jerry for a year and a half till after the strike. And Jerry wore that long black, like trench coat, like duster coat on road trips. And on every road trip, he left two tickets for Elvis. That was kind of his thing. It was was very interesting. I went from Elvis loving Jerry Glanville to a very defensive oriented Buddy Ryan in Philadelphia. Then he got fired and Rich Kotite took over. He was an offensive guy. And then I finished with Don Shula in for 1 year in Miami in 93.
Wow, those are great great head coaches' names, really. Different types of guys, every one of them.
Yes. Very, very different. I guess it wasn't old school back then. It was regular school back then. It would be old school now.
Right, that's right. So, look, we were 3 games into the regular season here. Give me some of your observations about, you know, how things are going.
Well, I think the two biggest surprises on the positive side have to be Pittsburgh and Minnesota. You know, now Minnesota probably would have started the season with Sam Darnold, and J.J. McCarthy may have taken over at some point, but J.J. gets hurt, so it's completely Sam's job. And, you know, Brian Flores running that defense, just such an aggressive defense. And Sam, what had got him in trouble at USC and early on in his career was turnovers, and he's avoiding the turnovers, which certainly helps. And for Pittsburgh going into the, you know, it seemed like Russell Wilson and Justin Fields had this competition, but it really felt like it was Russell Wilson's the whole time, as Mike Tomlin named him the starter before the first game, and then the calf issue popped up again. And Mickey, I don't know how you feel now, but I mean, certainly when we were in the game, it was like you couldn't lose your job to an injury. But it seems now that's a different case. It seems now, even if Russell Wilson comes back, I mean, Pittsburgh's 3-0, Justin Fields playing pretty good ball, that Russell wouldn't get his job back. I don't know how you feel about that.
Yeah, that was definitely the unwritten policy for you know, certainly when I started and for the majority of the time I've been in the NFL. But I think that has changed. And I think it's changed because of, you know, the impatience that we have general, you know, whether that's not just ownership, but the media, the fans, everyone's impatient. So it's man, you got to win right this minute. So I think that kind of dictates that, hey, if things are going well, you're not going to make a change. And yet I also feel like, well, if things turn a little bit, then you're going to make a quick change back to, you know, the original starter. So I definitely think that's true.
Yeah. And I would agree. And on the negative side, you know, seeing Cincinnati start 0-3 at 0-2, you weren't really alarmed because Zach Taylor had been 1-9 as a head coach in the first two games of the season since he had been there. So they had notoriously started slow, but giving up 38 to Washington in their loss on Monday night, they got some, you know, offense put up 33. You should win when you put up 33. The defense for Cincinnati was a bit disappointing, I would say, to say the least. So that's an issue, because if Joe Burrow is healthy, you always have faith that they're going to at least make the playoffs. But a little iffy with that defense, I would say. And Jacksonville, you know, being 0-3, but just paying Trevor Lawrence, but they just, last time they were 0-3 was 2021, and Urban Meyer was the coach, which doesn't bring back good memories for Jacksonville at all. So like every year, Mickey, as you know, there are surprises to the good, surprises to the bad.
Yeah, that just speaks to the, you know, the margin between the best teams and the bottom of the league. It's just not nearly as much as people think it is. It's so hard to win a game, and there's so many variables, and there's injuries involved, and there's just a lot of stuff. You know, any team really can beat any team in our league, and you know that. You know how hard it is to get a win, much less put together 11 or 12 wins, which is what it takes to get get to the playoffs and make a run at a championship.
And I heard you talking. I definitely think overcoming a loss is tougher than the win, or what is tougher to get out? You know, you get the win, you move on. You lose, you put all that effort into every week, and then you come out of it with a loss. It's damning. It stays with you. It can't stay with you too long, because you have to kind of forget it and move on. God knows it stays with the fans forever. But getting over a loss is definitely tougher. And you mentioned the injuries. I mean, every year there's a mass unit, and there's probably a couple, and there's a couple right in the NFC West with both San Francisco and the Rams, especially San Francisco. They are just getting hammered with injuries, and the Rams, both their top receivers are out. So, an offensive lineman, the Saints, Eric McCoy, is hurt, and they're playing Atlanta. I just called Atlanta's last game. And Drew Dahlman, the center, got hurt. Caleb McGarry, the right tackle, got hurt. Seems like a lot of old lineman injuries this year, but that's an old lineman, a couple for Atlanta, one for New Orleans. McCoy, you know, is a heck of a lineman too.
Yeah, and look, that's a position that I think typically stays relatively healthy in our league. And look, every team's going to have injuries. What really kills you as a team is when you have a lot of injuries within one group.
Yep.
You know, you mentioned San Francisco and the Rams, and Rams having, you know, receivers, a number of receivers get injured. And they had a number of O-linemen get injured as well. And so,
right,
man, when you get hit at one position group or two position groups on your team, with a lot of injuries, that's really, really difficult to overcome.
Yeah, yeah, it is. And you look at, you talk about the position group, both the wide receivers for the Rams, and then McCaffrey, Debo, and Kittle all out for San Francisco. I mean, there's just Jennings and Ayuk. I mean, that's the cover's getting a little thin there, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's a lot of production. A lot of production that you're losing. And look, the way that, you know, the way these contracts and the way the salary cap works, now you put so many resources in those top guys that you really, the rest of your guys have to be, you know, rookies and first and second year players that have low salaries or on rookie contracts. And they just don't have the experience. They may have the talent to produce, but they don't have the experience that it takes in our league to be effective.
Yeah, you know, we mentioned O-line injuries. Is O-line seems to be one of the – because the wide receiver, you should not have wide receivers contributing as much as they are today. Today, these wide receivers are coming in out of college, and they are just hitting star-level status right away. It seems the O-line, Mickey, correct me if I'm wrong, is the position that has the most troubling transition from college with the way the college game is played – to the NFL, and then you throw in the fact of just what you mentioned, depth, and you could have a real issue on offensive lines.
Yeah, you definitely can. And I think there's some truth to what you said. Look, I think probably for the first 30 years of my career, we would always assume that it would take a receiver 3 years to be able to get to the point where they could be significant contributors to your team. And then all of a sudden, and it's probably been about, you know, 8 years or 9 years ago, these guys started coming in and being immediate factors in our game. And that's continued at the top level of the draft. We've had first and second round guys, even a few third round guys come in right away and produce. And that, you know, part of that is, again, we get right back to the salary cap and sometimes you're forced to play these guys. And they do produce. So there's a lot of variables there, but I think you're right on when you talk about that transition.
Well, Mike, we appreciate your time. Good guys. Go Joe and go look. Mike Senior and Mike Junior, have a great rest of the season. And hopefully our paths will cross again.
Sounds good. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mike.
Let's pause 10 seconds to let stations identify themselves here on the New Orleans Saints Radio Network. When we come back, we will talk with former Saints offensive lineman John Stinchcomb, a former second-round draft pick. This is the Saints Hour on the New Orleans Saints Radio Network. Welcome back to the Saints Hour. Mike Hoss, along with Saints Executive Vice President and General Manager Mickey Loomis, and just honored to be joined by John Stinchcomb, second-round pick in 2003, TV analyst for the preseason games, longtime Saint, longtime offensive lineman. Lives in Atlanta, born in Atlanta, went to Georgia. Some things you can't change. You just can't change who your parents are and where you're born, but it is what it is. And so you know what Atlanta Week is. I'm curious, and then I'll get out of the way and let you and Mickey talk, but I'm curious as to what Atlanta Week feels like in Atlanta. I know what it means here. What's it like in there?
I love it because I feel like I'm behind enemy lines. First and foremost, very few people that are born and raised in Georgia are Falcons fans. They're not loyalist to begin with. So I grew up playing football in the backyard more than watching football, and certainly wasn't an NFL guru or fan that was glued to the television every Sunday. So there is no love lost between me and the Falcons. Now that I'm, you know, back home, if you will, I look forward to this week because I get to talk the most trash of any week out of the year, just with some friends that happen to claim to be the bandwagon Falcons fans when they happen to have some anomaly year where they're halfway decent, at least for a couple games. It makes for some fun banter back and forth, but I'll be a hoodat for life, and it's fun for some of the discussions that I get to have.
Yeah, that's look, John. I don't know what it is, but what was your record as a player against the Falcons? It had to be pretty good, right?
Absolutely. I'm sure there's some 13-year-old who knows the statistics better than I do during that window. But they're more fond memories than regrets when it came to that series.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I know you're pretty diligent about watching our games. Talk to me about your view of our left tackle, Taliese.
You tell me. I mean, so you draft him and you think, man, I really like his skill set. I talked to Jari after the draft and he was really excited. He was like, there was a series where I'm watching this guy and 19 straight plays, the defender he's going up against ends up on the ground. Like, he either, you know, pancakes him or chips him up or whatever. He's a physical player. You're really going to like his play. And so you get to see him in preseason some. And then for a first-round, first-year player, the way he's come out, one, I think it's a great combination of scheme and fit, right? You're always looking for a guy that fits in what you want to do. And early on, with just a few samples, the limited sample size that we have, it has been exceptional play just because he is so physical. And you see, you know, like most young players, there are certain things that pop up and there's mistakes that are made. But I don't see the recurrence of that same mistake week after week. So you're seeing him continue to get better, which, you know, is to be expected. But I think what's been so impressive is how high the floor is for him, that he's only going to get better. But yet the level of play that we've seen in the first few weeks of the season has been really high to begin with.
And John, look, take me back to your first year. What did you feel like were the toughest things about transitioning, from your career at Georgia to playing for the Saints? What were the things that you were really apprehensive about and that it took a while for you to adjust to?
Well, I'll tell you what it took a while for me to adjust to was Darren Howard. Thanks for that, Mickey. I mean, you talk about as a rookie practicing against, you know, for Darren, he was quick, he was powerful, and he had – his hands were about as active as any player that I played against my entire career. So it made me better. But I think one of the biggest adjustments that you make is – you're playing against professionals, and they are really, really talented at what they do specifically, and have these off the charts characteristics. And, you know, one week you're going up against some super huge human that is really powerful. And the very next week it's Robert Mathis in Indianapolis, who is not visually impressive. You know, he's a smaller guy, but is quick and elusive. And so I think, one of the biggest jumps for me was being able to adjust to what the players you're going to play against week in and week out, what they can do, and understanding your game, how you can lean in on your strengths against all those matchups. So it's always a combination of, you know, you don't want to solely focus on the guy across from you, but you want to be able to eliminate one of the first top one, two, or three things that player is going to try to do against you. And while you're doing it, rely on your own skill set. And as a young player, identifying what those strengths are is a huge key in assessing your own game and getting up to speed.
Got to take a quick break. We'll be right back here on the Saints Hour on the New Orleans Saints Radio Network. Welcome back. Mike Haas, along with Saints Executive Vice President and General Manager Mickey Loomis, as well as 2003 second-round pick John Stinchcomb, the offensive lineman who joins us today as well. And Mickey, the floor is yours.
One of the things that Talley's done remarkably well, I think, is played on the right side his entire college career, and now we moved him right over to the left side. And, you know, look, it's still playing in the tackle position, but talk about how that, you know, what makes that difficult. Moving from one side to the other, or what makes that an easy transition?
Yeah, so I think it's muscle memory, right? You've trained your body time and time and time again as to what's going to be anchor, what's going to be throw, how your body moves, and you're completely flipping all of those movements and skills. So there is a sizable difference when it comes to body mechanics. I think that's the biggest jump when you're switching sides is now your post foot becomes your kick leg, and all the mechanics of throwing your hands a little bit different. Your inside hand is usually your stronger, more dominant hand. And understanding those mechanics as they change, there's transition there. I think the easier adjustment comes to scheme when it comes to, all right, if this is five or six man protection, I know where my help is. I know where my landmarks are. I know where I want to get to and put my body. But I think it's the mechanics that makes the biggest challenge when you're moving one side to the other.
Yeah. And I'm just curious if how much reps play in that, because we watch this at training camp so much, because Fuaga and Trevor were both playing new and had both had done it before, but it had been a while. So the reps were just so key, because in this game, that guy on the other side of the line is such an athlete that if you that half a beat where you are thinking drop, you know, the battle's over, right? I mean, the reps have been so key for these guys in their position changes.
And they're fewer and further between than what I knew when I was a rookie. Mickey can attest the off season has been so truncated from what it used to be. It is a lot harder for a young player to get up to speed. Like there's just not as many reps. So I think it's more of an attestation to these young players and their commitment, because it's going to take some of that extra time. You're not going to get it all in practice to be able to get down the nuances. And, you know, the footwork is always key. It's not something that fans are going to see, but, you know, that half step, that first three steps that a player takes, especially offensive linemen, really can set you up for success, or you can lose the block before it even gets started. So being able to get those mechanics down, and like you say, Mike, not having to think about it. You know, if I'm thinking about my footwork, I can't play at my highest level. And so it makes you play slower. It makes you look less effective than when you get to that point where it's second nature. And there's the muscle memory where I know on an outside zone, here's my landmark. My feet are going to take care of themselves. I can play fast. And that's what you're trying to get to as a player as quickly as possible.
When you look at kind of, again, I'm just watching the game Sunday night, and Atlanta wants to run a wide zone, but they lose two offensive linemen. And I'm going by what the analysts are talking about, that you got Kirk Cousins now taking a ton of snaps from the shotgun. That is not what they want to do. I'm curious as to what they're saying in Atlanta about what they have to do offensively when you can't do what you want to do. You still got Kyle Pitts, still got Drake London, still got Bijan Robinson, don't get me wrong, but maybe you can't do maybe what you want to do because of the injuries.
Yeah, well, we saw there was a lot of chatter locally about week one, and you saw the number of snaps and how it broke out from pistol was run and shotgun was pass, and there was very little movement from Kirk Cousins, and there's questions of, you know, whether he can plant on that back foot and drive the ball. You saw progress in the next couple of weeks, but as we all know, as you just talked about with Mike Golic, the depth is an issue across the board, and suffering two injuries in one position group is a real challenge. I think, you know, you talk about the cycles of football, and the NFL right now has moved away just corporately from, you know, the five-man protection, shotgun snap, spread the offense, and we're going to throw it 50 times a game. We've seen more outside zone and play action pass, not just in New Orleans, not just in Atlanta, but across the board than what I've seen in probably the last 5 years combined consistently. So there is a transition that's taking place. If you don't have the right pieces to be able to do that, I think that's one of the beauties of New Orleans this year, is the scheme matches the personnel. You watch what Tali does really well. You watch, I mean, what we know from Penning is he's a big, strong, physical joker. And being able to utilize that skill set, specifically at the tackle position, has been accentuated. And you see the production that an offense can have when there's a good marriage there between personnel and scheme. And for Atlanta, the chatter has been, because two of your starting linemen are down, and you immediately saw a drop off in production from Atlanta this past week in their ability to set up the run, which then you're not able to move the pocket. You're not able to have that play action pass and slow down those defensive ends and edge rushers like you would. They're able to pin their ears back and come off the ball smoking. So hopefully that bodes really well for this defensive front for New Orleans when they come to town, and I'm pumped for it.
Well, I appreciate your time, Mickey. Help yourself.
Yeah, I know that's good stuff, John. I appreciate you being with us. Look, I've always had and always will have a special affinity for John Stinchcomb, because he was part of my first draft class as GM, and Thank God he worked out, because my first pick wasn't so good. thanks, John. Appreciate your time.
Hey, Mickey, appreciate the opportunity to be a Hoot App for life and for bringing me there and all the opportunities that you've provided since. So it's been a great experience.
There is a 13-year-old mathematician out there far better than me, but I believe it's 16 games with Atlanta that you played and you won 11. So not bad.
Boom.
Not bad. And that's our show for tonight. A big couple of weeks for this 2-1 Saints football team, both, of course, on the road, beginning at NFC South division rival 1-2, the Atlanta Falcons, on Sunday at noon in Atlanta. And then on the road again the following Monday night against the two-time defending Super Bowl champion and currently undefeated Kansas City Chiefs at Arrowhead Stadium in Kansas City, where the Saints have not been since 2016, a stadium that opened in August of 1972, 3 years before the magnificent Caesars Superdome. Wherever your travels take you this week, be safe, my friends, and we will see you next week and listening right here for the Saints Hour on the New Orleans Saints Radio Network.